From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. A new study finds that more people from Baltimore's Sandtown-Winchester neighborhood are incarcerated in Maryland state prisons than from any other census tract in the state. We visit two ex-offenders there who are working to change that statistic. Then, part neurosurgeon, part brain scientist, and part poet, Michael Saltzman talks with Tom Hall about a new anthology of poems he's edited that connect poetry and medicine. Plus, theater critic Jaywin Russig brings us her review of the Vagabond Players production of Rabbit Hole by David Lindsay Abaire. And the University of Maryland's men's and women's basketball teams have had terrific seasons in their first year in the Big Ten. We talk with a couple of sports reporters from the school's newspaper, The Diamondback, about how the Terps have done it. First, the news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. Welcome to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Where is home for an inmate? Until 2010, for census purposes, inmates in Maryland state prisons were considered residents of where they were incarcerated, places like Hagerstown, Jessup, and Cumberland. Of course, they aren't from those places, so that skewed the census data, giving rural areas a bump in population. But a 2010 state law said they must now be counted as residents of their last home address. That means that we now know exactly where Maryland inmates are coming from in the state.
Right here, to the left, this little thing here, this little hut.
Yeah.
This man adopted that lot right there. He sold candy and snowballs and things of that nature.
That's Anthony Warren. He's from West Baltimore's Sandtown-Winchester neighborhood.
I grew up in this house right here on the corner. For years. Actually, my mother lives over across the street over there.
A new report from the Justice Policy Institute and Prison Policy Initiative says that as of 2010, 458 people from Sandtown-Winchester or neighboring Harlem Park were in a Maryland prison. At one point, so was Anthony Warren.
I had a homicide. I was out there living in that type of world, the fast life, the fast money and all of that. A guy that was known for hurting people and all of that or whatever approached me with some negativity, saying what he was going to do, and he was known for doing what he said he was going to do. So it was either him or me at the particular time. So it turned out to be him. I did that. I served my time for that.
Warren is out of prison now and works with youth and ex-offenders. He guided producer Matt Purdy and me around Sandtown-Winchester on Friday.
Things have changed here, but it has been a lot of crime here. You know, if you ride around a lot of the corners, you'll see the police lights, the cameras and all of those things. You'll see that. But at one time, it didn't used to be like this. I mean, us as children, we grew up, you could go freely in this community, didn't worry about getting hit by any stray bullets or anything like that or what have you.
But Warren also shows us efforts, both from within the community and outside it, to turn things around. A farm graces land where vacant homes once sat empty. A neighborhood park, now buried under snow, hosts community events in the summer. Tidy rehabbed homes line certain blocks. But there remain the harrowing statistics. In the Sandtown area, more than half the residents of working age are unemployed. About a quarter are on temporary assistance for needy families. A third of the homes are vacant.
There are a number of communities in Baltimore that are driving the incarceration challenge within the state.
That's Mark Schindler. He's executive director of the Justice Policy Institute, which put the report together.
We also know, in looking at both the incarceration research and the data on how these communities are doing on some key indicators, is that, not surprisingly, these are very distressed communities and are facing many challenges. And so it shouldn't surprise us that, unfortunately, there's a higher number of people in these communities who end up involved with the justice system.
And Schindler says that costs a lot of money, about $37,000 per year for one inmate. He argues that money could be better spent.
we know that for $37,000, we could pay for employment training for 7 people. We could pay for a 2-bedroom apartment for 30 families for a month, and we could provide GED courses for 37 people. And so it really is policy choices and budget choices that are implicated here. And so our belief is that when we have data like what was presented in this report, it's really an opportunity for policymakers, elected officials, and others to really make better informed decisions on how we allocate our precious public resources.
In Sandtown on Friday, we sat down with Anthony Warren, as well as Antoine Bennett at New Song Community Church. Bennett is the director of Men of Valuable Action, or MOVA, which works with ex-offenders, helps them find jobs, provides mentoring. Anthony Warren is MOVA's Community Service Project Coordinator. The two men have a lot in common, both in their mid-40s now, both grew up in Sandtown, have family there, and both spent time in prison. Anthony Warren, as we heard, for homicide, Antoine Bennett for a shooting. Bennett said what led him to prison is essentially the same drive that now leads him to help young men in Sandtown, the urge to be part of something bigger than himself.
I went to prison because I thought the guy that I idolized, he went to prison, he came out a man. And so I thought this, literally for me in my thinking, was a rite of passage. But certainly, looking back on the hindsight, these young men don't have to go to prison. They don't have to join gangs to one. And I really, when I look at the core of this thing, it was really about belonging to something. And that's why it was easy for me to connect with the guys in my neighborhood and our neighborhood and create, you know, this gang type lifestyle and embrace it fully to the point where it resulted in me being incarcerated. We have to create avenues that are going to lead to positive outcomes. Prison is not the only trajectory for these young men.
The two have felt pain in the neighborhood as well as observing it. In 2005, Warren and his niece were caught in the crossfire of a robbery gone awry. He was shot. His niece, the mother of 5, was killed. That was 3 years after Warren's daughter was shot.
She was 8 years old, got shot in the chest in 2002. Where I saw this snowballs that around there, yeah. She was going around there to get a snowball right across the street. The little girls out there playing with the dolls or whatever. She stopped for a minute and started playing with them. Two guys got to arguing. Both of them pulled guns and started shooting on both ends at each other. They not even this close to try to shoot. They shooting from a distance. My daughter got hit in the chest. One little girl got hit in the stomach and in the foot. One little girl got hit in the back. One little girl, father tried to shield her, got his ear shot off. You know, had she been sitting facing either one of them, it would have hit her directly in the chest, pointing. But what it did, it went this way. And it didn't really penetrate her. It just like burnt her, which I was very thankful for that, you know. But that right there alone, it upset me and it really hurt me to see that happen. But for the most part, had I not been trying to change, that would have set me off. You know, because I'm like, this is my baby, you know. But by me trying, being in transformation, trying to do better, I held on, I prayed about it. And I say, well, you know what? I want to try to make sure things like this aren't happening at a larger scale, if any.
They don't argue violent offenders like they were should not go to prison. The argument is over sentences for nonviolent offenders.
If you statistically look at those who have been incarcerated, many of them are for nonviolent drug offenses, be it as drug sellers and or drug users. And we feel that, as Anthony stated, it should be other alternatives to that.
You both have poured so much love into Sandtown and seen some successes. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the big headline right now is Sandtown leads the state in the number of young people it sends to prison. Mm-hmm. So I guess that raises in my mind the question, do those numbers reflect the reality of Sandtown?
I would say certainly. It's
It's a hard reality that we have to deal with. Anthony and I could sit here and probably rattle off about 20 names, probably even more, of people we know personally who are incarcerated or who have repeatedly offended and out of prison all the time. And so we know a great deal of individuals in the community. We're talking close to 16,000 folks, so we don't know everyone, but by virtue of being lifelong residents here. And so we know that those numbers were reality over the last decade or so of people returning. And most of those folks, I would say 90% of those folks returning back to our community from these institutional men. As I said before, that's why our intentional effort has been to address the needs of the men, because they are leading the way. And young men are leading the way in terms of being incarcerated and returning back to a single community. But I must admit that I was blown away and pushed back at the number being raised to 458 returning to our little community of Sandtown. And, you know, it's disheartening. I certainly think that that motivates us to work harder to really, really make the impact that we would like to see and that this community deserves as it relates to changing the mindset, helping to change the mindset of these young men and women, but certainly the men who are returning back to Sandtown with the label of offender, ex-offender.
That was Antoine Bennett. He's director of Men of Valuable Action, or MOVA, which works with ex-offenders. Anthony Warren is MOVA's Community Service Project Coordinator. Eric Colbert chairs the group's board. At our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning, we have a link to the Justice Policy Institute report. It's titled, The Right Investment? Correction Spending in Baltimore City. Mark Schindler, Executive Director of the Justice Policy Institute, will speak with Dan Rodericks on midday at noon today on WIPR, part of an hour on parole reform. And you can take part in a discussion of the report tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. at the Open Society Institute, Baltimore, 201 North Charles Street. We've got details at our website. I'm Sheila Cass. Just ahead, poetry meets medicine. Stay tuned to 88.1.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We would love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's all at wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. The poet Michael Salzman joins me this morning. He's not only an acclaimed poet, he's also a neurosurgeon and a brain scientist. And those are actually not his only two professional interests, but these two particular interests are married beautifully in a new collection that he's edited. It's called Poetry in Medicine, an anthology of poems about doctors, patients, illness, and healing. Michael Salzman will be speaking at the Ivy Bookshop tomorrow night about the new book, and he joins me this morning in the studio. Good morning. Good to see you.
Good morning, Tom.
And speaking of poetry and medicine, you're coming to us with a tad of laryngitis here.
Yes, I am.
But thank you for soldiering on here. Right at the top of the book, in this beautiful preface that you wrote, you say that all of us are born patients. And in fact, you, at the age of 5, suffered from polio, and your cure for polio, you spent a lot of time in bed, and that sort of brought you to poetry, didn't you? And as a, and as well, it sort of brought you to medicine.
Yes, it made me a reader. And in the 1950s, the only two things you could do in bed was read and listen to the radio. And so that's what I did. And they were both activities of the imagination.
Yeah. So you grew up reading poems, literature, novels. Were you always drawn to poetry as a child, too?
I was. My earliest poetic interests were John Donne and Blake and Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah, Edgar Allan Poe, another famous Baltimorean. Yeah. Of course, the literature on poetry and medicine is, as you say in your beautiful introduction, it's voluminous, it's huge. I mean, there's a lot. So you have cherry-picked about, 200-plus poems related to all aspects of medicine. That's a daunting challenge to figure out how to wean it down.
It was very difficult. I could have made it twice as large, and for reasons, frankly, of cost at times and diversity, at the end, many wonderful things had to be cut out of the book.
Yeah, that's too bad. But you've organized this not chronologically, although the chronological scope of this is huge. I mean, you start basically, you start talking about the Hebrew Bible and the Aeneid, and you go right to contemporary times. But how have you chosen to organize it then?
Well, we chose to organize it thematically, and it begins with the basics of the body, such as anatomy and physiology. It goes on through diseases that are characterized by fever or by blindness. Then it goes into surgical conditions. It has a section on poems about surgical procedures and diagnostic procedures. It has a pediatric section called From the Children's Ward. It has a section giving the viewpoints of the loved ones of the patient called From the Other Side of the Bed. And then it ends up really with convalescence and hospitals and leaving medical care. With a hopeful note, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a really interesting and good way of organizing this, because you can sort of, go to those areas of medicine and healthcare that are of particular interest or might be particularly resonant at a particular time in your life and see these incredible writers. I mean, there's Shakespeare in here. There's great American writers. There's great European poets. There's contemporary folks and people from antiquity. It's really quite something.
And it's interesting to see how people from different times dealt with similar problems.
Yeah, and you make note of the fact that the evolution, if you will, of the literature about medicine has paralleled in many ways the evolution of medicine itself. That's an interesting connection there.
Yes, and the medicine and poetry about medicine both have an explosion in the 19th century with the development of the modern hospital. And then also the types of poems, the subjects, seem to parallel the major contagion or infectious disease of a particular period.
Yeah, so there are poems about the plague and poems about tuberculosis, and then in our time, things like AIDS. It's interesting how these parallels are drawn, but do you think there is a difference or is there a stasis, if you will, about how human beings have understood the mysteries and the art of medicine and the unknowns and the unknowables about our health and our well-being?
I think that the poems definitely become more and more sophisticated. They become more about the technology of medicine. They become perhaps less religious as time goes on. And of course, the subjects themselves make the change in the poems.
Michael Salzman is with me. He's the editor of a terrific new anthology of poems called Poetry and Medicine. It's an anthology about doctors, patients, illness, and healing. Narrative medicine is a subject that is now taught in medical school. So the training of young physicians now includes training about how to communicate, how to write and ponder and think about the science and the art of what you're doing. That's an interesting thing. Was that ever something that you encountered in your medical training?
Absolutely not. Hopkins actually was one of the pioneering institutions in bringing musical groups, classical music, to create some degree of humanistic sensitivity in their students. Columbia in New York actually takes the students to the different museums to study narrative painting and what it might teach them about their powers of observation as well as their empathy and their sympathy for the patient. And there are many schools now around the country that have a literature program. Rafael Campo, who's included in this book, has such a program at Harvard, and there are other programs around the country.
Yeah, I talked to a woman who edited a book about narrative medicine with examples of essays and stories, and it grew out of a column in Health Affairs magazine, which is a sort of wonky, you know, public affairs, public health journal, and they say that hands down, it's the most popular column in that magazine. Everybody turns to the narratives about patient care and those subjects first, and then they read the data.
Oh, that's amazing.
You know? Yeah, yeah. I mean, as a poet and with a person who has this great power of perception and observation, do you think that informs your work as a doctor?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it started very early for me in a sense because I fell in love with the Sherlock Holmes stories as a child and the power of observation of a physician and the ability to talk to the patient. And Dr. Bell, who was the model for Holmes in the Edinburgh Medical School where Conan Doyle studied, would stand in the well of the amphitheater and not even touch the patient. And by looking at the kinds of marks that were on the patient's fingers and hearing the kind of cough and knowing where he was working, would tell the students what the illness was.
Yeah, only in the movies, only in the books.
Yes.
Well, you talk about John Keats, famous poet who was also the first poet doctor. He was trained as a surgeon, I guess, although he never practiced medicine. Is that right?
Well, he's not the first poet physician. There have been poet physicians throughout history, actually. Rabelais was trained as a physician. Yehuda Halevi, the greatest poet of the Golden Age in Spain, was a philosopher and a poet besides being a physician. And Dante inscribed himself when he started out on a political career. He was part of the union, if you will, of physicians and apothecaries in Italy. So there have been a long chain of doctor writers and doctor poets. But certainly, without question, the greatest physician poet of all time is Keats, as being one of the greatest poets of all time. And he has the unique and heart-rending position of also having been nurse to his mother and his brother who died of tuberculosis and ultimately a victim of tuberculosis. So he was patient, nurse, and doctor.
Yeah, yeah, the full package of
the
experience.
Full package.
You wrote a poem. One of the poems in this collection is by you. It's called The Apprentice Surgeon, and it invokes Keats. So maybe you could read that for us.
Oh, I'd love to. It carries an epigraph from the American poet Wallace Stevens, "Death is the mother of beauty." How awful for him to cut the flesh or watch a deep cut made before carbolic acid, before ether, before hope was more than a wretch on the curb of the roadside, lungs etched with cavitation and fawn-colored phlegm. He knew how death would quirk his mouth, killing his speech, its beauty a necessity. Keats was an apprentice then to death, his own and all of life beyond its reach, the nightingale's song, the clay of ancient Greece, and that season of reconciliation for which he longed. Entombed in life, he felt no peace, despaired of fame and got some of it wrong while setting some right, dreamed of autumnal skies while standing at the bedside, attending to the horror at Guy's.
Poet Michael Salzman reading from the anthology he's edited. That's a poem that he himself wrote called The Apprentice Surgeon. Of course, we should make the point that you don't by any means include poems in here that are only by doctors and physicians. There are poems by, you know, a wide range of people. But you wanted to make, there are, I guess, a bunch of books and publications of work written by physicians like yourself. You happen to be a physician and a poet, but most of the folks represented in this collection are not in the medical field.
Yes, the vast majority are the greatest poets of history.
And when you choose poems like this, there are a bunch of poems, poets that you've chosen from Baltimore.
Yes.
And that's kind of a nice touch. We got Clarinda Harris is in there. You are in there, of course. Mary Jo Salter is there. I wonder if you could read one of Mary Jo's poems, which I really enjoyed a lot. It's on page 343, towards the end of the collection. Mary Jo Salter, a poet who's on the faculty at Hopkins, lives here in Baltimore. This is a piece she wrote called Half a Double Sonnet.
It carries the epigraph for Ben. Half a double sonnet. Their ordeal over, now the only trouble was conveying somehow to a boy of three that for a week or two he'd be seeing double. Surely he wouldn't recall the surgery years later, but what about the psychic scars? And so, when the patch came off, they bought the toy he'd wanted most. He held it high. Two cars, he cried, and drove himself from joy to joy. Two baby sisters. One was enough of Claire, but who could complain, considering that another woman had stepped forward to take care of the girls, which left him all alone with mother. Victory. Even when he went to pee, he was seconded in his virility.
Michael Salzman, thank you so much for your time this morning. Get better. Hope your laryngitis heals up soon. And thanks for sharing these some of these beautiful poems from this great book. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Dr. Michael Salzman, he's edited and written the introduction to a collection of more than 200 poems called Poetry and Medicine, an anthology of poems about doctors, patients, illness, and healing. The foreword to the book is by the former Poet Laureate of Maryland, Michael Collier, who directs the Breadloaf Writers Conference and teaches at the University of Maryland. Now, both Michaels, Salzman and Collier, will be appearing at the Ivy Bookshop tomorrow night at 7 o'clock to talk about and read from this fascinating anthology. We've got a link to all the details and a link to a wonderful conversation with Michael Salzman and Aaron Henkin that aired on The Signal a while back. Come to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. More coming up.
I'm Sheila Cast. Our theater critic, Jaewon Russick, has been to see the latest production from Baltimore's Vagabond Players. She brings us this review.
Rabbit Hole is a play about how life can blindside you. It's a play about grief, and it's a play about the difficulty of finding comfort. When tragedy strikes suddenly and unexpectedly, there's a natural tendency to look for someone or something to blame, or to feel guilty or responsible, to play the if-only game. All of these feelings rise to the surface in David Lindsay Abaire's 2007 Pulitzer Prize winner. Director Eric C. Stein's production at the Vagabond Players is sensitive and intense. Each of Rabbit Hole's five characters finds a reason to blame him or herself for the death of a four-year-old boy who was struck and killed by a car. The boy's mother, Becca, blames herself for being in the house on the phone, not watching her son playing in the yard when the accident took place. Becca's sister, Izzy, blames herself for making the phone call, and on and on. The sisters have wildly divergent personalities. Becca is high-strung, thin-skinned, and brittle. She knows what's best for everyone but herself, qualities Zara Rautel captures in her performance. Becca's pregnant sister, Izzy, played with naturalistic flair by Ryan Gunning, is impulsive to the point of getting in a bar fight with a stranger.
And people are looking at us, so I'm starting to feel self-conscious.
Of course.
And she's just going off, and I can't really do anything because the place is so crowded, you know? And she's a big lady, real hefty, so I can't even get around her to escape or whatever, and I'm starting to feel violated, you know?
Sure.
My personal space and my dignity or what have you, so I just made a fist, hauled off, and boom!
What does that mean?
It means I hit her.
No, you didn't.
Crazy, right?
There's friction between these sisters, and there's friction with their mother, broadly played by Amy Jo Shapiro, as a woman who turns out to be less crass and more caring than first impressions suggest. Becca's husband is a peacekeeper. He's desperately trying to keep this family, and especially his marriage, from coming unglued. Don Kamen delivers a keenly felt performance as this man whose method of coping with grief is diametrically opposed to his wife's. He wants to surround himself with reminders of his son. She wants to clear everything away. He's a husband who rarely loses his cool. One exception comes when a teenage boy, played by Brendan Morrison, shows up unannounced. Without giving away too much of the plot, this teenager appears to be the last person Becca and her husband would ever want to see.
We live here, okay? This is our home.
All right, Howard.
You don't just walk into someone's home like that, especially given the circumstances.
This high school senior has written a science fiction story that features holes, rabbit holes, that lead to parallel universes with, quote, versions of us leading different lives. So this is just the sad version of us? Becca asks him at one point. Rabbit Hole doesn't leave you with false hope, and Eric Stein's direction, wisely, never gives in to sentimentality. But for a play dealing with the messiness of grief, playwright Lindsay Abair includes some plot points that are a little too neat. Even so, the play's big issues cut right to the nerve. In times of great loss, can one person comfort another? Is comfort even possible? Not surprisingly, an effective production of Rabbit Hole is tough to sit through. You won't leave the Vagabond Players feeling consoled, nor should you. But you will leave with an increased sense of empathy and understanding.
Theater critic J. Wynn Russick. The Vagabond Players production of Rabbit Hole is up through March 29th here in Baltimore. We have a link to all of the details at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on Maryland Morning, we're talking Terps, University of Maryland basketball. Stay with us on 88.1.
If you have thoughts on that segment you just heard, email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
And good morning, everybody. It's Tom Hall with you here. Again, I suppose we could say that Maryland's first batch of March Madness came in the form of this horrible weather we've been having lately, particularly yesterday. But it won't be long before we'll be happy to welcome a different kind of March Madness when the NCAA basketball tournament gets underway. Selection Sunday, when teams are invited to the tournament, is just 2 weeks away. And certain to be invited to the big dance this year are the men's and women's basketball teams at the University of Maryland. The Lady Terps are undefeated in the Big Ten Conference, winning their final regular season game yesterday by beating Northwestern 69-48. It was their 21st consecutive win, tying a school record. They are the top seed entering the Big Ten Conference tournament this week. The men's team also won its final home game of the season on Saturday, beating Michigan by 10 points on Senior Day in College Park. Joining me for a bead on these two teams are Daniel Popper. He's the assistant sports editor and men's basketball columnist for the Diamondback, the University of Maryland's daily independent student newspaper, and Ryan Balerjian. He covers the women's basketball team, and they join me on the phone from College Park. Morning, guys. How you doing?
Good. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Doing great. Ryan, let me start with you. The Lady Terps are the third team in conference history to run the table in the Big Ten and the first since the 1998-99 season. They have had an amazing, amazing run.
Yeah, I mean, it's been incredible. What's really, I think, is the most impressive is
when you think about the fact that they graduated five seniors last year, including their all-time leading scorer, three-time All-American, and Alyssa Thomas, and to start three sophomores and change conferences and go to, you know, Brenda Freese was talking about yesterday, just how incredible it is to go to a new conference, play teams that most of these kids have never played against before, and night in and night out get the job done.
And it is a young team, which bodes well for next year and the year after that even.
Yeah, certainly. They only have one senior right now, and their sophomore class is really incredible. They've got three sophomores averaging double figures. Really bodes well for the future, for sure.
The victory that they had yesterday was their 21st victory in a row. Put that mark in context for us.
So that matched the single-season record in school history of 21, and now they are three games shy of the program record of 24, which they set during their national championship run in the 2005-2006 season, and then carried it over by winning some games the next season. So if they've got three games in the Big Ten tournament, if they win them all, so then they can match it then and break that record in the NCAA tournament.
And talk about the difference between the Big Ten Conference and the ACC, that Maryland, of course, was part of the ACC for many years. What were the expectations at the beginning of the season? Was the Big Ten considered a harder or a less challenging conference? Put that in context for us.
The ACC is definitely a little bit more top-heavy than the Big Ten. The coaches actually selected Maryland to win the conference. So the fact that they have won the conference isn't really a surprise. That's what a lot of the coaches have said when in the post-game press conferences after the Maryland games. But what's been surprising is the manner in which they've done so. I mean, they averaged beating their opponents by 15 points through the Big Ten, obviously didn't drop a game. But the players really pointed to a different style of play. They said it's a lot more physical, a little bit slower pace, but that really hasn't stopped Maryland. They're a top five scoring team in the country. They really like to push the ball in transition, and teams just really haven't had an answer for that so far.
And Daniel Popper, you cover the men's team. Talk about the difference between the ACC and the Big Ten and how the men's team has fared this year.
I think it's less of a drop-off compared to the women. The ACC and Big Ten are comparable in terms of talent, but I think that the Big Ten is notorious for being a tougher conference. There are fewer foul calls. It's tougher to get in the paint and make layups. You're going to draw more contact. So I think in that sense, there's a big difference there in terms of how tough the conference is and the amount of contact you're going to take before drawing a foul.
And the men's team did not lose a conference game at home this year. They've got two more games left in the regular season, but the excitement level on the campus must be pretty incredible.
Yeah, honestly, I'm a senior. I've been here 4 years. I really haven't seen this kind of excitement on campus regarding the basketball team. Obviously, the team is a lot better, but just being at the stadium for the home games, obviously going 9-0 in Big Ten at home, every game the stadium is packed. It's loud. People are excited. And it's really, really great to see from someone who's covering the team.
What do you attribute the success to?
I think primarily you have to look at Melo Trimble, who's the freshman point guard who's come in. Usually with freshmen, you don't see a lot of composure. You don't see a lot of composure. But he has both of those things. He has an incredible ability to make shots. He gets to the free throw line as well as anyone in the country. He's making close to 90% of those free throws. So I think primarily you have to look at him. But then again, across the board, you've seen guys step up. You had five rotation players transfer in the offseason. A lot of people had low expectations for this team. A lot of talent left this team in the offseason. You have guys like Jake Layman and Dez Wells. Both have stepped up this season. You know, Dez has been the leading scorer for the team over the last two seasons, and he's continued to do that this season, but he's sort of developed a different role. He's been facilitating a lot more. And then Jake Layman has been a completely different player this year. In years past, he's hung out around the three-point line, hasn't really attacked the rim, had virtually no post moves. This season, he's working out of the post and offense, and he's really using that long frame. He's 6'9", 7-foot wingspan. He's really using that frame to be a menace on the defensive end, too.
And Ryan Balerjian, talk about Brenda Free. She's been at Maryland as the head coach of the women's team for 13, 14 years, something like that. She is really a key figure in the success of this team. I understand she gave a particularly inspiring pregame speech a few weeks ago that really seemed to be a turning point for the team.
Yeah, she's great. The Big Ten allows her, she allows the Big Ten, access to her pregame speeches, and they're always great. Yesterday, actually, there was some video released after their win at Northwestern. The team broke out in a "We Undefeated" chant, and she had a 2 or 3 minute talk with the team about putting this in perspective. You know, she as a coach, she's had incredible success for a young coach, but she has never taken a team undefeated through conference play. So this meant a lot to her, and she just wanted the team to know just how much it really means, because this is a young team, and so the freshmen almost sort of are going to expect this next year. You know, I mean, they don't know what it's like to lose in conference play. So she just wanted to put that in perspective, and she just does a really good job with this young team of keeping them in perspective. You know, after every post game press conference there, after they won the Big Ten regular season title, they're like, this is great, but we still got the Big Ten tournament. We've still got the NCAA tournament. You know, mm-hmm. This is just
always looking ahead. That's right. Always looking ahead. Yeah. All right. Well, it's lots of fun to observe from our vantage point. It must be lots of fun for you guys to cover. So thanks so much to both of you for your time this morning. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
No problem. Thanks again.
Daniel Popper, he's an assistant sports editor and men's basketball columnist for the Diamondback, the University of Maryland's daily independent student newspaper. Ryan Balerjian covers the women's basketball team. They both join me on the phone this morning from College Park. The men's team faces off against Rutgers tomorrow night. They take on Nebraska on Sunday to finish out their regular season. The Lady Terps begin their quest for the Big Ten championship on Friday. We've got a link to more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Coming up Wednesday, a look at Lincoln's second inaugural on the 150th anniversary of that important speech and a conversation about the phenomenon known as curationism. That's all on the way Wednesday morning on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy
and Jonna McCone.
We have production help from
Estelle Klein
and Catherine Sway.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. Tomorrow is March 3rd. On that day in history, 1931, the Star-Spangled Banner, penned by Maryland's own Francis Scott Key, became the country's national anthem by act of Congress. We're back Wednesday. Hope you will be, too.